Schweizer Amerika. Views from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler. Grüezi miteinander and welcome to a new episode of Views from the Sister Republic. Since April 2, a day Donald J. Trump termed Liberation Day, many countries, including Switzerland and Germany, have tried to reach a deal with the US government and to get rid of the punitive tariffs that have been called reciprocal. Most economists in our part of the world agree that the tariffs are detrimental both to the US and to America's trading partners, as well as to the trading order and the international liberal trading order as we have known it. The think tank American Compass tells us otherwise, or well, its CEO and founder Orrin Kass has told us to be a bit more patient. In the New York Times, he wrote in May, "This instability may be worth it." Worth it for all of us or just for Americans? If you haven't heard about American Compass yet, you are certainly going to, because they are in the talks everywhere. Its founder and CEO, Orrin Kass, just published The New Conservatives together with a very illustrious team of contributors. And he has explained the vision of American Compass on, among other shows, Jon Stewart's talk show that is also very popular, I think, in our parts of the world. We are lucky to have one of the contributors to The New Conservatives, and probably a new conservative himself, on our program today, Chris Griswold. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chris, you are the policy director of American Compass, but previously you worked on the Hill, as Americans say, on Capitol Hill, where you were an advisor in the Senate. You were also a chief staffer for a congressman. And earlier you worked for an NGO in South Africa. Quite an interesting trajectory. Also, your academic background isn't, as one would suspect from the chapter you contributed to The New Conservatives, in economics, but you have a master in divinity from Princeton University. How does someone with an interest in religion and theology become a member of a think tank that has a decidedly economic focus?
It's been quite a journey. It's been a fun ride. I came to DC as a result of a congressional campaign in 2014, and came and kind of learned the hard way how DC actually works. And this was the height, I think, of what you might call Paul Ryan economics, and the doubling down in the first Trump administration on this old Reagan era idea that all you really needed to do to spur investment and promote widely spread, you know, prosperity was to cut taxes. And if that didn't work, to cut them more. And if that didn't work, then you should deregulate some stuff. And this was my introduction to how the Republican caucus in Congress worked. And by the time I had been here for a few years, it was clear to me that was not working. And I was very far from the only staffer having that crisis, that experience, that this dog-eared playbook that Republicans have been running since the 1980s of tax cuts, deregulation, and free trade hadn't actually worked out that well for working people, for working families, for all kinds of regions in and across the country, and not just kind of the rural Rust Belt communities that people think of when they think of Trump voters, but also plenty of urban and suburban communities as well that had been deindustrialized by globalization. Corporate profits were up, but wages had been stagnant for decades. There's something wrong with how we were doing things. If you are curious about why things are developing the way they are now in American politics, I think you have to look back 5 or 8 years to this burgeoning moment of rethinking. on the American right. Donald Trump got elected in 2016, and one of the consequences of that was that all of the norms were on the table for reconsideration, for better or worse. There were all the norms were broken and shattered, and everything was up for reconsideration.
But American Compass was founded after his,
yes.
or well, towards the end of his first
That's right.
Term. In 2020, yes. Were you part of the founding team?
I joined about a year after. I was working for Senator Rubio, Marco Rubio, at the time. And the reason I joined his team in 2019 was because he was one of the few conservative leaders who was open to seriously rethinking these questions, right? So from the 1980s, conservatives have been defined by this three-part coalition of social conservatives and economic libertarians and Cold War hawks, defense hawks. And the thing they had in common was a hatred for communism and a desire to beat the Soviets. And they did that. But that coalition didn't really make a lot of sense afterwards. And in fact, the tensions between economic libertarianism and conservative values started to reveal themselves. And Rubio was one of the people willing to be honest about that and say, okay, you know, Trump broke open this moment. Trump is good at breaking things, maybe not so much at reconstituting them in a coherent, orderly way. And that fell to other people to start to think through, well, what is a renewed conservative economics really look like? What is the intellectually coherent vision here? And so that's the work I was doing for him. And that's how I came to American Compass, because American Compass really is the one organization in DC dedicated to advancing a renewed conservative economic vision. And so if you see more and more Republicans now saying things like free trade has downsides and tariffs have an important role, not everything that Wall Street does creates value. Maybe corporate interests are poorly aligned with the common good and the national interest in many cases. Maybe big tech's innovations are not always healthy. Maybe labor unions are good. Maybe antitrust enforcement is important. All of these things that now more and more Republicans are saying, that all happened for a reason. There is a coherent intellectual vision that undergirds all of that. And that is what American Compass has been providing since we were founded in 2020 to help restore an economic consensus that emphasizes the importance of family, community, and industry rather than just free market fundamentalism.
So was American Compass mainly founded as a response to what was happening with Donald Trump's election, or was Donald Trump's election a part of a symptom of what American Compass leaders and founders were anyway picking up, and the two things just coincided to an extent?
I think it's a bit of both. I think Donald Trump's election was in part a reflection of a frustrated voting public that knew far better than DC did that the status quo had failed economically. And that's also incidentally, of course, why Bernie Sanders did so well in the Democratic primary in 2016 and might well have won that primary if the DNC had not put his thumb on the scale in that contest. The public was looking for something new, and Trump was the candidate willing to say most clearly that the status quo had failed. But I think people were and gave that kind of political permission that opened that rhetorical and political space. But I think people were getting there anyway, because his election, it was both a symptom and a cause, I think. And you look back at say, the 2012 election and the way Mitt Romney talked about a lot of these things. And my boss, our founder, Orrin Cass, you mentioned, worked on that campaign and has written quite eloquently about what he learned from the inability of a lot of the distinguished economists on that campaign, their inability to grapple with what was really troubling the public. The fact that our trade relationship with China was damaging, the fact that there was an opioid crisis that no one seemed to be paying attention to in DC. I think that was transformative for him even then. So yeah, both a symptom and a cause with respect to 2016.
Now, American Compass is a think tank. You were previously part of the machinery of Congress. What makes someone like you, who really had primary access to decision-making processes, decide to go out of the machine and into a think tank? What are you hoping to achieve through that part that you could not do from within?
Well, I think, I mean, both are needed. But in my case, and especially because, you know, you're situated in the academic setting and a lot of your listeners and audience is in or around the academy, it's because ideas matter. They matter a lot, actually. And my encouragement, I guess, to anybody who thinks that they don't and that politics is just all bare-knuckle partisan brawling, I think is missing what's really happening in at least in America at the moment. Ideas are incredibly influential. And being able to put a name and an intellectually coherent explanation to a feeling that the public had for a long time, that something was wrong, is incredibly powerful. It's also incredibly helpful to policymakers that are also trying to evolve and innovate their way towards better solutions and better ways to frame the problems and explain the problems that we're facing. It's a great job. It's a fun job, and it's an impactful job. You know, we, as you said, we only started 5 years ago, and now I think are not to talk our own book immodestly, but I think are widely recognized as the most influential new think tank in DC, and it's because we were able to provide that intellectual foundation for a lot of these discussions on labor and globalization and industrial policy and tech and financialization and so on.
Now, you said ideas matter, and that's a profoundly conservative attitude. Those who have been listening, how you outlined the beginnings of conservative economic thought, may also be familiar with National Review, which was the flagship conservative publication that started with its principles declaring that ideas rule the world. But the question sometimes is, do your ideas still align with the right political camp? And one might be wondering, with all that you outlined being the faults of conservative economic thought of recent decades, really, what you called the Reagan consensus and also the Paul Ryan line of thinking in reference to the former Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, who had been representing the state of Wisconsin. Why are you still focused on influencing Republicans primarily? What do you want as new conservatives to conserve, and why not switch camps and become Democrats?
Well, there's a whole lot to say there. We should talk about Reagan himself and the complicated legacy he represents on this question. And we should talk about think of as a new emerging bipartisan consensus. And that's partly speaks to your question. So let's get to both of those. But first, I want to draw a very sharp distinction for your listeners between libertarian economics and conservatism, which is surprising for a lot of people to hear because they have been synonymous or thought of as synonymous or conflated for three or four decades, at least since the 80s.
In the U.S.
Yes,
absolutely.
In the U.S., yes, absolutely. Again, because of this, I think, marriage of convenience in the context of the Cold War and so on.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot of fun to go back and look at some of the founding fathers of modern libertarian economics, like Milton Friedman and Hayek. Hayek has a great essay called "Why I Am Not a Conservative." The reason he says that he's not a conservative is because of his profound faith in the mysterious workings of the market, that even if we don't know quite how it works, we should trust ourselves to it, as opposed to relying on some type of inherited wisdom from our forebears or whatever. And I think that's a pretty elegant way of capturing the essential idea that underlines all these other ideas that characterizes new conservative economic thinking, which is that the market is a tool. It's not an end unto itself. And that matters enormously, because certainly Republican economic policy, and honestly center-left economic policy as well, for decades, has seen the market as an end unto itself, the free market as an end unto itself. And similarly with free trade, and assumed that whatever the market optimized for, or whatever the global trading system optimized for, was by definition the most socially beneficial, the most conducive to societal well-being, and so on. And that is just clearly and demonstrably not true. And if you admit that that's not true, what you then have to do is ask yourself what your deeper value set is. If it's not the case that, I mean, look, the markets optimize brilliantly. That's what they're for. And they do it better than any other mechanism we've discovered. But there's no guarantee that what they optimize for will be conducive to human flourishing. And so you've got to grapple with, okay, what do conservative values really tell us matter? Well, strong and healthy families matter. Strong and healthy local communities matter. Strong and healthy national industries that help a nation be strong on the national stage matter. The ability and to affordably start and raise a family matter. All of these things matter, and libertarian economics has failed on all of these counts. And that's the distinction I think I would make of why, of the, what distinguishes the old right, so to speak, from the new right on economics. Why that is not progressivism is, one, because of that value set. I think one of the unfortunate, you know, when I talk to my progressive friends, they'll be honest with me that there is a kind of metaphysical paralysis on the left. There's a deep discomfort talking about fundamental values. You know, if you want someone to unfold why the, you know, UN Declaration on Human Rights is important, find a progressive. If you want someone to tell you why human rights matter or are real, they'll struggle. And that's what my progressive friends tell me about the intellectual state of the American left. The right is much more comfortable in a metaphysical mode. And I think that's important. I also think a respect for markets matters. You know, all too often the progressive answer is to just assign these functions to the state instead of the unregulated free market. The new conservative answer is no, you just need to put better policy parameters on the market so that what it optimizes for is in the national interest or is conducive to human flourishing, which is in fact what Adam Smith was trying to tell us originally when he talked about the invisible hand. If you go back and look at the paragraph, he only mentions the invisible hand once. And in the paragraph where he uses that phrase, it's so interesting to go back and look. He talks about how, well, assuming that, you know, this person has a preference for domestic industry over foreign industry, and assuming XYZ, then, as if by an invisible hand, the pursuit of profit will redound to the, you know, the benefit of all. It's when the pursuit of profit is aligned with what's conducive. It's almost a tautology, really. When it is aligned with human flourishing and the national interest, then by all means, the pursuit of profit is the most efficient way to get there. But it's only policy that can constrain the market appropriately so that those spillovers are what we want rather than what we don't want. I'll stop there. I know I said we should talk about Reagan, but I'll stop pontificating for a minute.
Yeah, Reagan went into hiding when you faulted libertarian policy for what has been happening in the American society in general and for American families in general. Because you said that at the end of the day, the market should be a tool to achieve what I would summarize as the common good.
Yes.
And the common good, if I'm paraphrasing you correctly, consists from the perspective of conservatism in healthy families, families that know to flourish, strong local communities, and in general value order. Is that a fair summary?
The ability to have a dignified life where you live, which is a quite a simple goal, you would think, but it's one that's increasingly out of reach for a lot of working Americans. Again, I mean, what is our unregulated free market optimized for these days? Well, the concentration of opportunity and wealth in a few coastal cities, a few industries, and so on. I mean, it is not working well, even by that very simple and presumably universally agreed standard that you should be able to have a dignified life where you're from if you want. And we're even on that level, we've failed quite badly. But yeah, the common good is a useful phrase. And you know, I've been using the term new conservative economic thinking. My old boss, Senator, now Secretary Rubio, used the phrase common good conservatism, or common good capitalism. On the left, someone like Elizabeth Warren will use a phrase like patriotic capitalism. And I think these are attempts to describe a respect for the irreplaceable function of the market, but a suspicion that the market will do what we need on its own without appropriate policy constraints. And the funny thing about Reagan is he actually himself did understand that better than those who have, I think, kind of hijacked his legacy a little bit. He negotiated voluntary export, agreements with Japan on autos to save the American auto industry very successfully, kind of forcibly relocating production of Japanese cars to the U.S. domestically rather than importing them. In his famous speech where he famously says that the 9 scariest words in the English language are "I'm from the government, and I'm here to help." Later in the same paragraph, he then brags about how his budget offers more assistance to farmers than ever before and how it's the role of government to make sure that this essential industry is supported. I think he himself is more complicated and was much more practical than we remember him as. And you asked earlier about, what is the relationship between studying religion and studying economics? And I think it's worth pointing out that fundamentalism works the same way, whether it's economic or religious. You find your sacred text, which is probably a misunderstanding of what that text was saying in the first place, and you insist upon no deviation at all. Any breach of that orthodoxy is heretical and needs to be controlled, which is how a lot of the groups in DC, for example, that insist you can never raise taxes on anything ever, because they know that once you admit that it's sensible in even one instance, the whole apparatus falls apart. That's how fundamentalism works. And that is how I would characterize the libertarian economics of the last few decades as free market fundamentalism, this ideological commitment to something that in actual reality hasn't really worked and that frankly doesn't really understand its own source texts either.
I mean, part of that, what you call fundamentalism, is that it tells us to focus on GDP and GDP per capita. And on that account, one has to say America has been faring better than anyone else. A recent cover of The Economist was America's economy being the envy of the world, particularly if you're comparing it to developments in Europe. And now one might be inclined to argue people that are trying to have a new American economic compass are risking that envy of the world by imposing these tariff regimes, by suggesting there should be other measures put first above GDP. What is your response to that kind of skepticism towards your agenda?
Yeah, I would say a few things. One is that GDP tells you it's an important figure and it tells you something real, but it's incredibly incomplete in the picture it gives you about the health of an economy and the health of a society. Wages, as I mentioned, have been stagnant for working people in the US for decades. Inequality has been rising for a long time in the US. I mean, the top quintile of families have gained position in the last few decades. Everyone else has lost relative position. And you're pointing to an important fact, which is by the standards of this kind of market fundamentalism, it did succeed. If all it cared about was maximizing GDP and maximizing the amount of cheap imports we can get from China and lowering kind of the cost of some consumer items, then yeah, we did that. That was just the wrong goal. It was the wrong set of metrics, and that kind of failed to account for the much richer picture that you need to have if you want to understand how people are actually doing. We have a metric that we developed called the Cost of Thriving Index, which just measures the cost over time of a basket of basic goods that you could call basic middle class, basic middle class standard of living, housing, transportation, schooling, food for a family of four, so on. To achieve that basic level of middle class security in 1985, the average male worker needed 40 weeks of income and then had 12 weeks of additional income to save, to invest, to take a vacation, whatever. It now takes an average male worker 62 weeks of income per year to afford that basket of goods. And for the average female worker, it's in the 70s. That is a, I think, a distillation. That is a better metric that captures the urgency of the situation I'm describing, that basic affordability is slipping away from more and more American people, even as GDP and corporate profits rise and do fine. That the distribution of that prosperity is not equal, or even particularly distributed at all. Another fascinating stat is if birth rates are falling all around the world. That's true in the U.S. But if you ask Americans who are having fewer children than they say they want, what the reason is, working class and middle class people will tell you the primary reason is affordability. They're worried they can't afford to have another child. And so if you're talking about a basic conservative value of, look, if you want a family, you should be able to have and raise one. And if the reason why that's not happening is in part economics, well, that's a big problem. And we should probably do something about it. And you can go on down the list of the crises we're facing in terms of supply chain dependence on China, in terms of whole regions of the country that have been deindustrialized, in which no industry has replaced those lost industries. So from a national security perspective, an economic stability perspective, a job quality perspective, a family affordability perspective, we are in trouble on all of those counts. So yeah, it's not to say GDP doesn't matter. I would love to see GDP keep rising rather than fall. Of course, everyone sane would agree with that, but it's not the only metric that matters.
But how about the current tax regime? Well, Arne Kass, your CEO, has actually been one of the few people to say anything positive about what has been going on. Do you really think that this is the path towards a reindustrialization of America? Is this really the recipe? While others, you've seen the stock market react, the bond market react, you've seen the instability that it has brought to the world economy. Is that really the way forward?
And for clarity, you're talking about tariffs specifically?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think the basic question at stake in the tariff debate is whether or not it matters that we make things or not. There's that famous quote from an economist, I believe in the George H.W. Bush administration, who famously said, computer chips, potato chips, what's the difference? You know, a dollar is a dollar, whatever the economy, whatever the free market decides is the U.S.'s comparative advantage. We should just do that thing. And the flaw in that reasoning is now utterly apparent to anyone who cares to look at the immense vulnerability that the U.S. and the EU as well has in its supply chain dependence for chips on other parts of the world. It's an immense problem, and that's why the U.S. had to pass the CHIPS Act. The EU and Japan and other countries have taken similar steps. It was a mistaken assumption that we could get away with that for long. And tariffs are one important tool in the toolkit for rectifying that. All a tariff does is say, hey, we are going to adjust the parameters around the market to make it relatively more attractive to make something in the US. So if you talk about, say, for example, a 10% baseline global tariff, if there's something that another country is still really good at doing more efficiently than we are, well, then we'll still presumably be importing that. But if there's like a marginal edge case where, you know, maybe we could be doing that, well, now we have more of a reason to. I think it's also fair to point out that trade deficits are real and that they matter. This is another violation of economic orthodoxy, which long held that trade deficits are self-correcting and don't matter. Neither of those things turned out to be true. So tariffs have an incredibly important role. That having been said, and actually, before I move on, it's important to note that The U.S. economy traditionally has been quite in favor of tariffs, you know, all the way back to Alexander Hamilton and Henry Clay and the development of the American system. Abraham Lincoln, when he was running, said, give us a tariff and we'll be the greatest nation on earth. This is, in fact, the American tradition, and it's only in the last several decades that we've forgotten that. It is a return to a sounder economic tradition rather than some deviation from the American way. But tariffs also are not the only tool. And I think my criticism of the Trump administration might be if it ultimately thinks it can achieve reindustrialization through tariffs alone, that's a mistake. We also need a whole bunch of other policy interventions. For example, an industrial finance corporation or development bank of some kind to help finance critical industries that the market doesn't want to. I think is a good example of something we need on kind of the carrot rather than stick side of things. And there's a long list of other things that matter. There's an essay I wrote called Not by Tariff Alone, which makes this argument. So no, I don't think it's possible to do it just with tariffs. I think it's going to be very hard to do without tariffs. And the tough message, I think, for our friends around the world is it is actually quite urgent that the U.S. reset our trade relationships. That is important. If we don't...
If I may interject right here, because one conservative value is also reliability and that one honors one's... relationships, the bonds one has formed, etc. And I think there is good reason to say that the way these tariffs have been introduced and the way they have been calculated isn't really what one would expect from an ally, now looking from the European perspective. So from the perspective of American Compass, would this have been the route that you, if you had been an advisor here, would have suggested as well? Or were you also surprised by how this tariff regime was introduced?
Yes. No, you mentioned a New York Times piece that my colleague Oren wrote a while ago. In that piece, he was highly critical of the way tariffs were rolled out on Liberation Day. Because you're right that we are quite vocally supportive of the spirit of the matter, right? This is directionally correct. It's important that we do something in this vein. Even the Biden administration had been tiptoeing in this direction, I think rightly recognizing that something was amiss in our trade relationships. But optimally, the way we would have wanted to see it done is through legislation that offered a clear and predictable path. So, okay, you know, tariffs will go up by 20% next year and 40% the next year or whatever to give companies time to relocate back to the U.S. or to shift their supply chains or to alter their investment patterns in, you know, the way that this policy is designed to achieve. Dropping a huge tariff overnight, I think, does cause unnecessary pain. That is not, it's not a necessary feature of this shift. That having been said, it is also notable that a lot of the doomsday predictions have not come true. These tariffs are not inflationary. In fact, tariffs just simply are not inflationary. The retaliation that many people feared from other countries has not materialized, as we've seen in the last few days. Even
we're petrified, you know.
Well, I mean, and you know, there's these new trade deals being announced just in this last week with Indonesia and Japan, maybe soon the EU. So, look, I recognize the concern, and I do think it's fair to criticize this administration for maybe treating our friends in the same tone of voice as we treat our adversaries like China. Mm. That, I think, is not necessary. And I do wish that we had offered more legislative clarity. Yes. But as I say, on the other hand, I think it's incredibly important that the EU take very seriously the reasons why this is happening, the legitimate concerns that this trade regime, that the alteration of our trade regime is intended to accomplish, because the EU faces some of the same challenges we do. You know, China can come in and undercut your markets with cheap stuff just as much as they do with us. I think it's an incredibly dangerous prospect that the EU has kind of toyed with a closer relationship with China. That would be bad for Europe. And I hope that doesn't happen. The old global trading system is no longer fit for purpose and it needs to be remade. And I hope we could do that together with our friends and allies.
A lot of economists have been critical of the focus on manufacturing. And this is a criticism I personally do not share because I find it very persuasive, as you and your colleague write in both the New Conservatives as well as in opinion pieces that have been published here and there, that manufacturing does indeed provide very great career options for people who do not take an academic track and who do go into a trade direction, and that it also has the advantage of being possible to flourish in any corner of the US. I'm currently in the Midwest in Indiana. This is a region that is testament to the downfall of manufacturing industries. But one of the major problems Swiss companies have, for instance, said that they would not mind producing in the United States, is skills, a lack of skilled labor. So it's not about unskilled labor that can be, quote unquote, imported through migration that is easily tapped into, but it's the question of skills. And what I found very interesting in the book as well is that you're actually thinking along the lines of what we already have in Germany and Switzerland, that you want to see apprenticeships or vocational training strengthened. But we are witnessing that these tracks are actually losing, how shall I say, support and respect, that there is a tendency for parents particularly pushing their children all through high school, for employers not recognizing the values that people with an apprenticeship bring, and that is often superior to those who have a fancier diploma, etc. So how do you want to bring an economy that is so geared towards college degrees, to take a different direction and actually see more value in alternative paths?
Yes. Well, first, a word about manufacturing in general. I'm so glad you agree with the proposition that manufacturing matters. But I would add that I think there is often a somewhat thin version of the pro-manufacturing argument, especially from some politicians who like to talk about jobs, that makes it sound like the only reason or the principal reason to reindustrialize America is to give people good jobs. It is true that manufacturing jobs, especially the advanced manufacturing jobs that characterize, I think, 21st century technology, do tend to be better jobs. That is certainly true. And we certainly would love to see more of those jobs available than we have now. But especially as productivity-enhancing technology and automation and other technological advancements continue, it's entirely possible and, in fact, I think desirable that a given factory will need fewer workers than a similar factory 10 or 20 years ago. The reason to reindustrialize America is not primarily as a jobs program. It's because manufacturing and productive capacity plays such a unique role in a healthy economy. The ability to make things, as we mentioned, is fundamental to national security, to economic stability and supply chain resilience. The ability to produce something tradable good roots regional and local economies in ways that purely service sector jobs cannot. If you have a factory in the middle of a town, that's what enables a whole bunch of other good jobs, better service jobs, for example, to flourish around it. It is the unique role that making things plays in an economy. That's the reason to manufacture. So I just want to kind of push back a little on the manufacturing as jobs program kind of thinking, because that is not the way I would argue for it. Yeah.
No. It's also I have this wonderful example just in my vicinity in Elkhart, Indiana, where they are still crafting RVs and that bring also employment to the big Amish community around here, that it is also something that brings people together in a way that remote service jobs can never do, and that honor old trade skills and bring them together with the newest technology, etc. And I think that's a layer that manufacturing has that we don't see in that many other industries.
I think it's very well said. And it speaks to your second question about the kind of relationship of economic policy and cultural norms. It's certainly true in the U.S. that non-college pathways have not been seen as, you know, with the same kind of social respect as going to college and getting a degree. That is absolutely true. And of course, it's also been true that on the whole, college degree is a better path to an economically dignified future as well. That is not universally true. And in fact, it's breaking down and we are overproducing college graduates who have a lot of debt and difficulty finding a well-paying job. So I think that is changing. But yeah, it's a huge problem in the U.S. And I think a big part of this populist backlash on the right and the left that you see is a desire for respect and dignity and regard from your fellow countrymen, as well as a desire for a more economically viable future. These are related things. And the way the U.S. anyway has been investing tax dollars in our education system does not reflect that at all. We dump almost all of our federal education tax dollars into higher education, which really only serves a minority of Americans well. What we need to be doing is investing far more rigorously and expansively in non-college pathways and on-the-job training and apprenticeships and so on, as you mentioned. And there are also ways, I think, that you can start to tilt the social aspect of this as well. One of the proposals that we've recommended, and I've written an essay on this as well, is to just ban the requirement that you have a college degree from job descriptions. If you want to post a job opening, you may not say bachelor's degree required. That would be quite powerful. We've already done that in the federal employment sector. President Trump in his first term and then continued by President Biden banned the use of college degree requirements for federal jobs in most cases. Many state governors in both Republican and Democratic states have done the same for their state workforces. I think we should do the same in the private sector. And not only would that open more actual economic opportunities for people without degrees, it would send a very strong signal just in general to the culture that this is not required to be seen with dignity and seriousness in our economy. I think we should do that, for example. And there are many other things we could debate doing, but that's one that comes to mind because it speaks both to the economic and the social dynamics you're, I think, quite rightly pointing to.
Yeah, I find it really interesting in the whole book when you're speaking on upskilling and looking at alternatives to college degrees, but also in the ways that you want laborers, workers to have more of a say in the economy as such, in corporations as such, how you're also looking at European models. And I was often thinking to that I heard like a faint echo of what used to be Christian democracy or social democracy as well. To what extent were you and other contributors inspired by European precedents?
I think it's been very useful and constructive to look at other models around the world that have worked better than what we've been doing. I'm a big fan of sectoral bargaining, for example, where you can bargain, as your listeners will know far better than most American listeners, where you can bargain at the industry-wide level and then have non-adversarial works councils at the, you know, enterprise level, the workplace level, for cooperation and discussion. That is a better model than what we do, which is enterprise level, business by business fights over whether or not you can unionize. And then when you do, that's your only option for engagement with management. Our labor system in the US, I would argue, is no longer fit for purpose and needs to be updated quite badly. The decline of the labor movement in the US is not a good thing It shouldn't be celebrated by conservatives, but restoring it will require some creative thinking. And it has, of course, been useful to look at other parts of the world. The Gentz system as well, whereby a worker control organization can administer benefits using both public and private money, I think is a much better model than what we have in the U.S. For something like unemployment insurance, for example. So certainly been inspired. And it's interesting because the U.S. doesn't really have a Christian democratic tradition the way Europe does. And I have heard it said by some that one way of describing what American Compass has done is reverse engineer a secular version of Christian democracy. I don't know if that's fair, but I've heard it said. And it's interesting to note too that you didn't cite this influence, but it's worth noting how influenced a lot of these figures like J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, the new chairman of the Federal Trade Commission, many of my colleagues as well, and myself are influenced by Catholic social teaching. I'm not Catholic myself.
I was thinking about that a lot, but I saw Oren Kass writing that he actually didn't know what it is. And then I thought, how influential could it then have been for American Compass?
Quite influential. I think he's being a little tongue-in-cheek, but you know, Oren's not Catholic. I'm not Catholic. It's not a religious exercise in that way, but that tradition, I think, captures very well the need for something that is neither Marxism nor unfettered laissez-faire capitalism. And what that tradition, I think, very eloquently describes is the way that both of those economic systems ultimately, at the end of the line, dehumanize and do violence to the dignity of the human person and the dignity of the human family and local communities and so on, which is, of course, true. History teaches us that that is certainly true for totalitarian Marxist regimes. It's also quite clearly true for unfettered capitalist regimes that let the market run amok, which is what we are reacting to in the American context. Something other than either of those things is needed. Something that respects the role of private property, that respects the role of families and local communities, but that also respects the role of government and the need to set appropriate bounds on the market and what is and isn't subject to market forces and what the market is and isn't prompted to incentivize and optimize for.
One final question on the book, because I have already taken a lot of your time, but one thing that has struck me when finishing it was that a lot of the battles that conservatives have been fighting over the past decades remain unmentioned. All the culture war issues beyond the question that family matters, that community matters, they remain untouched. You're not also touting the horn of American democracy, the brilliance of the founders, all that stays outside of the book. Is that because American Compass has this secularism as part of its organizational identity, or was it a choice so that the focus remains on the questions that matter most to the organization right now, namely the economic question?
Well, I'd say two things. One is just we are an economic policy think tank. That's what we do. There are other people whose business is to fight the culture wars and to debate those issues. There's no need to.
Yeah, but when you're calling yourself the new conservatives, you make a bold claim that you want to be more than just the new economic conservatives.
Well, and I think the danger of some of the culture war stuff is that it's not to say there aren't important questions. Of course, they are important. In some cases, they just happen to be things most people on the right or center already agree on and don't need to be litigated on the right. And in other cases, I think they are a distraction from these deeper structural questions that need to be resolved if we are going to achieve a healthier economy and society. But we are primarily an economic policy think tank. That's what we do. And I would also note, of course, we'll praise the brilliance of the founders. One in particular, which I mentioned, is Alexander Hamilton, who was a huge advocate.
That's true. For, he appears time and again.
Exactly. A huge advocate for heavy federal investment in critical industries and infrastructure. Huge advocate for the importance of smart tariff policy to protect industry. And that, as I said, that tradition was, and I think remains, the true American economic tradition. So yes, of course, we've got some founder love there.
To conclude, there is always the same question to guests of Grüezi America, and that's, what next? What should our listeners listen to, watch, or read next to better understand the issues we've discussed today? Chris, what are your recommendations other than, of course, The New Conservatives?
Well, please do go and read The New Conservatives. That's our attempt to collect a lot of the essays that have formed the intellectual backbone of this movement I'm describing. Listen to our podcast, The American Compass Podcast. We've got really, really fascinating guests every week. And we just launched a magazine called Commonplace. Which is, to your question, you know, American Compass is focused on economics, but there is also a need for a home to have these wider debates about the country, about conservatism, and so on. Essentially what National Review used to do, and provide this intellectual home for important debates. So if you are interested in a wider range of topics, check out our magazine, Commonplace. And then in terms of what to watch, we just celebrated our fifth year anniversary. We had a big party in D.C., and both Secretary Rubio and Vice President Vance gave remarks. If you're interested in how this style of thinking is playing out with those two figures, take a look on our YouTube channel for those remarks. And then lastly, just to be a little spicy, if you're curious about some of the language that does, I think, influence a lot of my colleagues, go read Rerum Novarum from 1891, which is Pope Leo XIII's encyclical on capital and labor and the need for better economics that respects human dignity. You hear it cited a lot in D.C. These days.
Yes. Senator Rubio, I think, set a trend there. Rerum Novarum is, I think, the encyclical that he cited most. And I think having now a Pope Leo XIV bites well for the next encyclical to be in that tradition.
I think so. I look forward to reading it.
Chris, thank you so much for taking time to join us on Grüezi America. We're so glad that we had the chance to chat with you. And to all our listeners, thank you for your interest and auf Wiedersehen.
Grüezi America, views from the Sister Republic, a University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler.